Today on Movie Wallahs, we discuss The Theory of Everything and Horrible Bosses 2. It's time for Movie Wallahs. Hi, this is Joe.
Hi, it's Rashmi.
And Yazdi as well.
Movie Wallahs is your weekly dose of film reviews, movie news and general banter in theatres, on DVD, online streaming or in the back of an airplane. If you love the movies, this show is for you. Hello, hello.
Good evening.
Hello. It has been literally ages since we recorded.
I know, I've missed you.
Hunger Games.
Recording. I mean, I live with you, so.
Interstellar.
Interstellar. Yeah.
That's what it was.
We've just been consumed by watching movies. That's what's kept us
really,
from recording.
It's true.
Well, little thing in a way called Thanksgiving.
Yes.
As well.
But not just that. We've just been watching, trying to catch up with the year-end films.
Yeah.
Haven't we?
It's amazing. I hate what...
Pigs in poop.
We talk about this every year, but I do hate the fact that everything gets held back for award season. Even things that aren't necessarily, in my mind, going to make awards, they hold them back just in that little glimmer of hope that they might pick up an award or two. So it's kind of irritating.
Yeah, and it used to be a strategy that studios used where they deliberately held off up until like 2 days before Christmas or 3 days before Christmas. I know Clint Eastwood would always release his movies around that time and suddenly they would get a ton of nominations because people would watch them at the very end. But this year it's backfiring for a lot of movies. In fact, a lot of movies did not get a Golden Globe nomination because they think that the people who vote just did not get a chance to watch, you know, catch up with them.
Right, because voting in actually happens way earlier, right? So, Yazdi, right. You just voted on Monday for the San Diego Film Critics. And so you've literally got a month less than everyone else to watch all of these movies, which is ridiculous.
Right, we voted on December 15th, we had to have our nominations out a week in advance. Which means by early December, we'd have had seen all those movies.
And some screeners haven't even arrived yet.
Yeah, and some movies had a single they could only do a single screening. Like, I've been hearing great things about this movie called Selma.
Yeah.
Yes.
You know, and all that the studio could do was 1:10 a.m. screening when everybody was at work. And, you know I missed that movie and I'm really, really regretting it. So I think it might backfire. They really need to start kind of release, like Gravity came out last year around Thanksgiving, and I think that's a good time. It gives you a couple months for it to kind of percolate, settle in, for people to get enough momentum
and get a chance to see it. Yeah,
and compare and contrast as well. I mean, I've been seeing, you know, I know that from about September onwards, if you hear our podcast, I've been going, here's my favorite movie of the year. And so I think that it's difficult when you haven't got much to compare against. You get all of the good ones. So yeah, I'm with you. I think they should come out a little bit earlier.
Yeah.
Studios, listen to Movie Wallahs. But SDFCS, San Diego Film Critics Society, did vote, and Nightcrawler was the big winner this year.
Yeah, I think our critics group, considering we are not one of the major, major ones like LA or Boston or New York, we always pride ourselves in being a little bit off the beaten track and picking movies that are not necessarily more of the same by the time those nominations are out. And I think we did really well this year.
I think you did really well this year.
Especially because we gave so much love for Nightcrawler, which had been kind of lagging behind a little bit in all of the other awards considerations. And, you know, Rene Russo, for example, who did so well, you know, but hasn't been getting any love for a Best Supporting Actor turn, Best Supporting Actor female turn. You know, we picked her. So hopefully if enough critics groups pick these movies which are not getting enough attention, then it might help their general cause.
And I was so happy that Riz Ahmed was even nominated.
Yes, and he was, you know, and
I mean, that was a standout performance for me.
Yeah,
and here we go again with our Nightcrawler review, which we kept talking about.
Episode 253 of Movie Wallahs. If you haven't listened to it, listen to it now.
And didn't we say that got the award because it's the most talking we did after the podcast was over? Like, we kept talking about the movie.
Yeah, and there's genuine love. I think a lot of people, feedback I've received since our awards came out, or since our final winners came out, is that we had some kind of conspiracy where we all decided, let's be different and vote another movie. But that wasn't the case. People in our critics group really genuinely have love for that film at every level. They love how it is shot, how it presents LA probably as best as anybody has since Michael Mann did in Collateral, you know, about how well it's written, about how
the character,
you know, about the main character. Yeah. And Riz Ahmed, I can tell you, I mean, he was one of the people who got as many votes as, you know, as almost as many votes as the top runner. Yeah. So.
No, it was a standout performance. Yeah.
Anyway, not that this is a review on Horrible Bosses too, but
here we go again.
He's a surrogate for the audience in a way, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so should we move on to this week's reviews?
Yep, let's do that. So which one do you want to do first?
Horrible Bosses 2, because it's been a horrible work week.
All right.
I can vouch for that. Amen.
My boss isn't horrible, thank God.
Oh, neither is mine, but it's just been a bad week.
Hopefully
at work.
He's not listening.
Yes.
Notice how I didn't say anything? Yeah. No, my boss is awesome, but yeah. Go ahead, Yessi.
So Horrible Bosses, the original movie, was a surprise hit. And it starred Jason Bateman, Jason Sudeikis, as well as Charlie Day. And it was one of those movies which kind of was under the radar, and then it took off, and it's done tremendous business on the DVD circuit. And you know, most people have a lot of fondness for it, and the studios, realizing that, was quick to churn out a sequel, and therefore we have Horrible Bosses 2. Jason Bateman playing Nick, Jason Sudeikis playing Kurt, and Charlie Day playing Dale are the three goofies. Who return back, and this time they have a harebrained idea to sell a device where you can shower and administer shampoo at the same time. And sure enough, before they know it, they're involved with a crazy, nefarious, evil man played by Christoph Waltz, who is an owner of a large corporation, and Chris Pine, who is his just as feckless and evil son. And things go off kilter, as they tend to in this movie, in this chain of movies. The movie is directed by Sean Anders, with screenplay by Sean Anders as well as John Morris. And as in the previous movie, Jennifer Aniston is here, so is Kevin Spacey. I already mentioned Chris Pine and Christoph Waltz, and of course, many of the other players from the earlier movie also return back. So, you know, this movie actually has been out for a couple of weeks, and it's been doing remarkably good business. It's still in the theaters, I think, 3-4 weeks after its initial release. Is it well earned?
So this is funny from the outset, but it's definitely a sequel. I mean, it's great to see the same characters again, because the first one was so funny and I loved it so much. I'm a total Jason Bateman fan. And I think the first one was different in the same way that The Hangover was different. Mm-hmm. But this one feels a little bit too put on. And the ante is amped up, and not always in a good way, I think. Sometimes it's really, really funny, but it's just not consistent all the way through.
Joseph?
You know, I wasn't the biggest fan of Horrible Bosses. I mean, it was you know, it was fun enough stuff. And I think the most memorable thing for me, and probably everyone, was the Jennifer Aniston character mm-hmm. in that movie, which was a standout. This movie just didn't work for me. I mean, I found it annoying all the way through. The most frustrating thing for me was the first movie at least had some ingenuity around how these bumbling, you know, three dudes go about dealing with their situation. But this was just watching three idiots. I mean, this was dumb, dumb, and dumber. I mean, or dumb, dumber, dumberist, whatever it was. The three characters was just so innately stupid all the way through that I found the thing annoying, and it just wasn't funny at all for me.
Yeah, so it can go one of two ways, right? It can really annoy you, or you just give up and you say, okay, I'll watch it for it is. So for me, it was the latter. I actually laughed a lot, and I fully recognize that it's stupid, but I think it's almost like those Dumb and Dumber movies where it wants to be stupid. And I think, not to give too much credit, but I think the script is reasonably at least conscious of the fact that it is a sequel. It's conscious of the fact that a lot of the movie actually, you know, is, in fact, they even mention 9 to 5 at one point, you know, because it that's what these movies are. It's about these guys trying to get back at their bosses who are like unbelievably, comically, improbably evil. And, you know, Colin Farrell, I'm not giving anything away, died, you know, in the first one. So they're left with, you know, Jennifer Aniston and Kevin Spacey. And now this time they bring in the big guns with Chris Pine and Christoph Waltz. So I think I kind of enjoyed the movie in the way you might enjoy, you know, a Friday evening movie with a beer, you know, while you're probably reading, you know, solving a puzzle at the same time. Yeah.
This would annoy me when drunk. I mean,
this is the thing. I think it did more versus better. So I think they made Charlie Day more stupid. They made Jennifer Aniston more sex crazed. And I think when it relied on their on the three of them just being funny together, that was when you got the most joy. But I have to say, Chris Pine was a great addition, and he does funny really well. I mean, it was really nice to see him funny again. But I feel instead of 9 to 5, it borrowed more heavily from Ruthless People.
Oh God, that's a much higher bar. I love Ruthless People.
Yeah, I mean, that same sort of idea. Yeah. But it felt like it was too derivative. It didn't feel like anything new. And I think I had such high expectations because I enjoyed the first one so much. But like you, Yazdi, I found myself literally bent over double laughing at some points.
I mean, really.
And I kept thinking, oh no, they're not going to do that. They're not going to do that. They're not. Oh my God, they just did that.
Yeah.
I can't believe it.
I mean, some of the dialogue. I mean, the movie's not... Is it rated R? It probably is, but I certainly hope so.
Yeah,
I think the movie visually is not that offensive, but certainly in terms of its language, it's really pushing it. I mean, the language is really strong in this one, and I agree that the whole Jennifer Aniston thing, you know, they're pushing it so much that it's not working anymore. I think, but the rest of the stuff, I agree. And going back, since you brought up Chris Pine. You know, I'm so glad he's doing what he's doing, because he could have just played the straight, you know, jock, you know, in movie after movie. And he's really doing this, and he's pretty good at this. He's trying his comic chops, and especially in a movie we'll be reviewing soon, which is Into the Woods. The kinds of roles that he's taking, I think Chris Pine doesn't have the need to be in a sequel playing the son of the villain who is stupid. But he does it, and I think he has fun with it. So I admire that.
Yeah, and he's good.
I agree with everything you say, but I think my main issue with this one is it was kind of like The Hangover 2, where they took a film that was reasonably well executed in the first go, and they do it all again. And so, you know, there's part of me which is annoyed by its laziness, because it doesn't really throw anything new into the mix. It just does the same thing over again. It's not quite the carbon copy that Hangover 2 was of the first one, but it's just... It's beyond slapstick, and in its humor. And you know, when you're like, I can't believe they're going to go there. I was like, they're going to go there. They're going to go beyond, and that's exactly what they do. And so, it just smacked to me as lazy. They didn't do anything new with the characters. Kevin Spacey was entirely missing from this one, and he was a really fun aspect of the first movie. And we did get the chance to rewatch the first one, because they're running Horrible Bosses on TV. I think it's TNT or one of those types of channels. So we got to watch a slightly sanitized version of it, but you know, enough came through to remind me of
how
clever
funny
some of the ideas were in that first movie. I don't know if
the second time.
I still didn't love it, but I think I was reminded of what a great concept it was. You know, it's a really nice setup for some comedic.
Yeah.
Occurrences, you know, three people hate their bosses, want to do something about it. This third movie just seems so forced in its delivery. Sorry, the second movie, seems so forced in its delivery.
You feel like you've watched so much, it's already become a third
I know, right?
I agree with what you said earlier, Rashmi. I think the best part is, I think what makes this work is the chemistry between the three male leads. And, you know, Charlie Day is stupid and Jason Sudeikis is just as unreasonably
weird.
And then, you know, Jason Bateman's a straight man, and you know, so I think the chemistry between those three really works. And for me, the big surprise was that, you know, I used to think so highly of Christoph Waltz as an actor. I thought he would kill every situation he's in, and it's kind of surprising to see that he doesn't quite kill it. As
me too.
You know,
he only does well in Tarantino movies for me.
He's only done well in two Tarantino movies.
And he's won two Oscars.
Remarkable in those.
And he's been incredible.
Is it time to ask him to give back his Oscars? I don't know.
Or get him to just be in Tarantino movies.
Yeah.
Again, I think, you know, I think about this a lot, but some actors do well with certain directors because the director knows how to get the most from that actor. They write roles for that actor. And he's a great example of somebody who just struggles. I mean, he was in that terrible Green Hornet movie that came right off the bat of Inglourious Bastards, where we saw him. And I was excited just for the fact that he was in it, only to see him fail miserably doing anything meaningful with that role. And you know, it's the same here.
All right, let's wrap this one up. So, Yazzie, why don't you go first?
So, I think this is a great movie to watch when you're drunk or when you're intending to be drunk with your friends on a Friday night after a few beers.
Who are your friends?
but I enjoyed this movie. I cannot lie. And there were times when I literally couldn't stop laughing. And so I think this movie doesn't have high ambitions. It could have been so much better. But being what it is, it did not offend me. It did not annoy me. It gave me 2 hours of reasonable laughter. Somewhere between a 6 and a 7. I'll be generous and give it, oh, I don't know, I shouldn't, but I will give it a 7 out of 10. maybe that's too generous.
You know, this is just a lazy, almost inevitable sequel. You know, it exists only because the first one did so well. There was no reason that this script, there was nothing special about this script. There's nothing special about these characters. There was nothing special about the humor in this movie. So, you know, you can always, at least in my mind, spot a movie that knows it's a little desperate for laughs when they put in the outtakes at the end credits, and that's what they did here. And, you know, that was probably the most enjoyable part of the 2 hours that we spent in the movie theater. So I'm going to give this a 4 out of 10. I really, really wrestled with this one.
Wow.
Didn't like it.
Overall, overcooked and overused jokes made this an okay sequel. Enjoyable, but not brilliant. I would say save this one for the back of the plane.
Yeah.
6 out of 10.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe on reconsideration, I'm going to back my score down to 6 out of 10.
But the funny bits were really funny. I mean, there were some hilarious, I mean, and no, I just love Jason Bateman.
You know that time?
It was just stupidity.
No, you know that time when, you know, you're kind of half jet lagged, you're kind of in between time zones, you're flying over an ocean, you know, there's 6 more hours before you're going to reach your destination, and
yeah,
it's dark,
you've got nothing to lose,
you have nothing to do, and everybody else is sleeping, and you're kind of in this weird phase. I think this movie is great for that time.
I think you're right, but then you'll laugh so loud you might wake others up.
Right.
See, that's when I put on a Japanese show about ramen that's in Japanese.
Oh, and that puts you to sleep.
And it's just perfect entertainment. That would be better entertainment than this, even though I can't understand a word of Japanese.
And we have done that. Joe made me watch a Japanese noodle
Wasn't
show.
It good?
It was really good.
It was really good.
Made us really hungry.
Entirely in Japanese.
We just kept watching this. Yeah.
It was like food porn. All right.
I'm all for food porn, yes. On to our next movie.
Movie number 2.
Considerably more respectable, yes.
Is The Theory of Everything. I'll intro that. So The Theory of Everything is really about the story of the world's greatest mind, or at least thought to be the greatest mind alive today, Stephen Hawking. It's based on a book written by his wife, The Traveling to Infinity, My Life with Stephen, and directed by actually an Academy Award-winning director, James Marsh, who directed Man on Wire. So he did a documentary, but it was a terrific movie. The movie basically follows the story of a once healthy young man, Stephen Hawking, who receives his earth-shattering diagnosis at the age of 21. He has his wife fighting tirelessly by his side as he embarks on his ambitious scientific career. Together, they defy impossible odds, breaking new ground in science and medicine and achieving more than they could ever dreamed. At least that's how the movie tagline reads. This is one that I've been really, really anxious to see. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to get to it. I had a work thing, I think, a work conflict the night of the screening, but I know the two of you have seen it. So what did you guys think?
So this is a really moving story about what people do for love, set against a backdrop of this incredible biopic of Stephen Hawking. The first thing that strikes you is the chemistry between Felicity Jones and Eddie Redmayne. I just fell in love with this couple and they were mesmerizing to watch. That's in addition to Redmayne's brilliant portrayal of Stephen Hawking, which will for sure guarantee him an Oscar nod. I love this movie. It really moved me.
Yeah, you know, what a great story this is. And I always say that for me, a test of a great film is one where you afterwards wonder why no one thought to make a movie about it sooner. And it's such a great story. And like you, Rashmi, it moved me tremendously to see the dignity being taken away from this intelligent, smiling, twinkling man. And the initial parts, which are pretty romantic, if you will, then settle into something more worldly, less starry-eyed, but very respectfully complex and human. And, you know, I thought the movie was going to be one thing, and I think only the first 45 minutes of the movie is what I thought it would be, and then what it settles in for is so much more complicated and so much more real and more earthbound and less, you know, it deals with what it is to be human and to face undaunting odds. And any movie which can, you know, bring you to that point where you just come away with wonder at the lives of these two individuals, I think has done its job well. I think this is one of the better movies of the year.
One of the things that I've read a couple of reviews of the movie, and one of the things that I think worries me a little bit is that it's less of a story of Stephen Hawking, because I'm very interested in the man and, you know, the legend that he's become, the science that he's done. It's not so much about that. It's more about the relationship between the two people. I mean, is it more of a love story than it is a biopic of Stephen Hawking? Because that's, you know, what I'd like to see is the Stephen Hawking story.
I mean, I think the biopic provides the framework for the love story. And the love story in the sense of what two people do for each other and the sacrifices and the troubles and tribulations they go through when two people truly love each other. But I didn't realize that this was based on the book from her perspective. And it's clear when you're watching the movie that this is definitely the story from her point of view.
Right.
And I think even though it is a bit mushy at times, it's handled so carefully that you never walk away thinking, oh, that's just a sappy piece of crap. It's very moving, and I think Felicity Jones' portrayal of Jane is so heartwarming, and you just admire and feel for her at the same time, and that's a really hard thing to pull off, to feel sorry for someone, but then to admire them as well. And it's I honestly think this is incredible acting. I think she'll get a nod for her portrayal as well.
Yeah, she should. And this is what I wrote in my notes as well, is I often wonder... Remember now, amongst the three of us, I have seemingly the greater affinity for Schmaltz. And even then, I always wonder, when you're getting into that territory where you are dealing with something that is, you know, overly emotional, very heightened, why does it work for some movies and not work for others? Why did it work in The King's Speech?
Right.
You know, but it didn't work for me, for example, in Mandela. But that's me personally. But King's Speech, everybody universally loved it, when it's a lot of it is emotionality. And I think... it's very hard to get into that place where you somehow don't trigger the audience's cynicism, you know,
right.
That
yes.
even when you're going for those very big arcs, the very high highs and the very low lows, that you go along for the ride without rolling your eyes. And I think this movie does a magnificent job with that. And even, you know, even though I think... particularly the first act of the movie is very hard to watch, because that's when you see this person being handed this harshest of fates. Mm. Just to watch the dignity with which not just him, but I mean her, you know, the two of them, how they navigate, not just in the moment, but a year later, 2 years later, 4 years later, when things around them change, their situation changes, their circumstances changes, their affiliations for each other's change. I mean, the movie does a remarkable job, and that's why I think... had the movie only been about when Stephen Hawking first met his wife, it would have been a fine movie. But I think by virtue of the fact that this movie decides to follow their journey through the years, it's a strange thing to say. It gives the movie so much more strength, because then it becomes so much more mature at that point.
So I think, Yazdi, I'm trying to think about the answer to your question, like why do some films do it better? And I think... films like The King's Speech and this one tackle adversity in a realistic way. That's not to say that, you know, the adversity doesn't get the Hollywood treatment, but you see probably how real people deal with the situations. These are difficult situations that people are in, and the way that the adversity is shown and then dealt with, I think that's what contributes to the lack of the... cynicism in a way, because you kind of see them go through that journey. Maybe that's what it is.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing that helps this movie is an incredible score. Mm-hmm. And I don't often notice scores unless they kind of hit me and slap me in the face. An incredible cinematography. Mm-hmm. Scene after scene is breathtakingly beautiful. And it captures the England of Chariots of Fire or Brideshead Revisited. And I mean, there's just this one beautiful scene, and they keep showing it on the adverts where the sky is lit up. Mm-hmm. I've got goosebumps as I'm speaking about it. And there's fireworks, and you see the two of them, the back of the two of them looking at the fireworks.
It's on the bridge, isn't it?
I mean, it made me gasp. I mean, literally, it took my breath away. And great editing, and the score just adds to this movie. It's just, my God, it's something sublime.
I think So I think it, for me, visually, the first 45 minutes of the movie, when these two individuals meet each other in the prime of their life, it's so beautiful. It's so overtly, intentionally, deliberately beautiful.
I wanted to hug them.
I realized it's a conscious choice that it couldn't have been that beautiful in real life, but the movie is making the point that in their eyes, at that point, the world truly was a wondrous place because they'd found each other. And that, in a way, that beauty kind of fades away. And it kind of, even the gleam through which their events are seen starts to dull visually. And I think that's a very deliberate intent on the part of the director to make things gorgeous and beautiful and shiny at the start. And then things are not gorgeous and beautiful and shiny, and they're kind of scuffed and, you know, edged and, you know, as the movie goes on. So it's kind of reflected in the visual tone of the movie as well, which was very smart. And I think this movie is nothing. I mean, you talked about this. This movie is nothing without these actors. And, you know, you know, it's award season and everybody's talking about great acting, and God knows I'm the biggest fan of Jake Gyllenhaal, and I think his time has come, and, you know, he's been doing amazing work in movie after movie.
And varied.
And, you know, just this year with Enemy and Nightcrawler, whatever it is. But if I have to look in my heart and admit what's the best male performance I've seen this year, I don't see how anybody can even come close to Eddie Redmayne. Nobody can come, not even Jake Gyllenhaal. I still want the award to go to Jake because of the total, you know, the totality of his work. But in this movie, just think about the degree of difficulty, right? You're portraying one of the most brilliant minds in the world who happens to be alive right now. But more importantly, you're dealing with somebody who has disability. And if you don't do this right, it can be not just awful or comical. It can be so offensive. And a lot of people have complained that all he's doing in his acting is copying Stephen Hawking's. No, you're not copying. You're inhabiting that role.
You are. I agree. I mean, he is literally wearing the body of someone who has ASL. And ASL just became... ALS just became so big in the news in this last year. I mean, I was just thinking, I wonder whether that was a publicity stunt for the movie. I'm not being that cynical, but it's interesting to me that, you know, that whole water challenge with the ALS came around. I mean, it's so in the news. So he's in a very vulnerable position. He is amazing. I mean,
amazing. I mean, one of the things that people often say with roles like this is it's kind of a gift for an actor because, you know, you get to portray extreme adversity, you get to do like physical transformative type stuff. And, you know, is that the case here, or is he doing something more nuanced, you know, kind of deeper, more complex in terms of his craft?
All I have to say, Joe, is I know, yesterday you didn't get to see the film You're Not You with Hilary Swank in it. Joe and I were lucky enough to see that at San Diego Film Festival, also about a lady who gets ALS. Night and day, Joe. Night and day with those performances. I mean, Hilary Swank is
slacker.
She did a really good job in that movie of having ALS. This made her look like she was in like, you know,
pantomime.
Yeah.
And I
mean, I'm not kidding.
Wow.
He is amazing.
Yeah, I think the reason why that works so well is because he's a double threat, right? I mean, so he gets the physicality right. And the movie starts right from at the 45-minute mark. He's going up and down stairs on all fours, okay? So, I mean, it's not something he suddenly, you know, suddenly he's devastated at the end of the movie. So the physicality of it is very overt and intense, right, you know, pretty early on in the movie. But beyond the physicality, I think he gets the emotional beats of this character so well. And I think I don't know how to say this without giving things away about the last act of the movie. But for me, the last act of the movie was so powerful because it's about other people who become part of their lives and how each one of them deals with it and how each one of them This is the world. This is the reality of how things change as you get older. And there's a scene on the beach where this person, who is friends with them kind of picks him up and grabs him and, you know, just takes him to the water. And I mean, even when I'm talking, you know, it gives me chills down my back.
Yeah.
Wow.
Because this kind of stuff, you know, things happen in everybody's lives, but to kind of get that emotionality right and to kind of amplify it for a movie is very hard to do. So, So really, I mean, it's pretty remarkable.
Yeah, we're going to gush all evening otherwise.
You're going to have to score it, guys.
I know I'm doing it a horrible, horrible disservice by giving it an 8 out of 10, but 8 and 8.
Why
yeah.
so low? Given everything you've said, why so low?
I don't know.
And that's not low. It's surprising because you've gushed.
Well, it's definitely an 8.8 out of 10. Maybe, I don't know.
What's stopping your mind?
It's okay.
Let me think about it. But
okay, let me go then. Yeah,
he needs to brew a little.
Okay. Gorgeous score, beautiful cinematography, a really interesting story, amazing acting. This is a heartwarming movie that made me grateful for love and sort of educated me about the man Stephen Hawking. Along the way, Oscar, 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 all the way, 9 out of 10.
Wow.
And I'll give you the reason why I'm not giving it a 10, which gives you a little bit more time to think about his score.
He doesn't have to justify his score.
I think that if I look at the film objectively, then it could be a little bit too much love story. That's why it doesn't get the 10.
But it
because it's not
upon,
just so well-rounded.
It's based upon her.
Based upon her book. So, correct. You know, that's one of the things that worries me about the movie, because I really want to see, you know, the story of Stephen
right.
Hawking
for the
astrophysicist perspective.
So, you know, I think from the Chris Nolan fan who goes and sees it, I'm not sure that you would be as enthralled as, you know, Mr. Smushy and Miss in the Middle.
But I do think the movie does not dumb down the science.
No,
there's
it doesn't.
A fair degree of science in it. You know, there are speeches that he gives, you know, his defense for his work and all the other lectures he gave and so forth. So I think the movie is fairly steeped in science.
But it warms the heart more than it educates the brain.
Yeah, yeah. And just in case I don't do a disservice, I mean, I made it seem like Eddie Redmayne is some kind of god, which he is in this movie. But again, you know, Felicity Jones, she matches him. And granted, she doesn't have to carry the physicality. But in terms of what happens to her character, again, in that final act, she is remarkable.
Yeah,
I don't know. There's a period in the movie, and again, I'm giving things away possibly, but there's a period in the movie where she's the sole caretaker of a person, you know, who is very, very physically incapacitated. And she, without ever saying a word, she portrays a person who is so exhausted, but is still carrying through, dragging through. And how many times have you seen this in real life with people?
Yeah.
And just her face, I mean, she never once complains, but just to see her face, seeing how much of a toll this is taking on her, you know, that's what great actors do.
Yeah, she's an interesting one because she hasn't really had any major lead roles that I can remember. I feel like I see her everywhere. Like, her face is very familiar, and she's always kind of a joy when she appears on screen. But
this is going to put her on the
this
map.
This is really...
This is her coming out party.
Yeah, no, terrific. Good for her. I think she's fabulous. All right. Mail at moviewallahs.com. Let us know what you think of these two movies. Twitter.com/moviewallahs. Follow us on Twitter. Get our tweets, our episode announcements and all sorts. And our Facebook page. Join our growing community of MovieWallahs Facebook fans at facebook.com/moviewallahs. We have a couple more podcasts to record right now, so look out for more episodes of MovieWallahs coming to you soon. Until our next episode, too many movies, too little time. A good night from me.
And me.
And me as well.